Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Will Edwards, Event Marketing Manager for Three Square. The organization has a few events going on right now that focus on tackling hunger in different ways. Will, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, thank you for having me, Heather.
So for those who aren't familiar with the organization, what is Three Square?
So Three Square is Southern Nevada's only food bank and largest hunger relief organization. We service four counties, Lincoln, Nye, Esmeralda, and Clark counties. We acquire food, and with the help of 150 community partners, we get that food out to our hungry neighbors.
Okay. Now, one of the things you have going on right now is Restaurant Week. Tell us more about that.
So this is our 17th year doing Restaurant Week, and we do it to raise funds because there are more than 341,000 individuals in Southern Nevada who are struggling with hunger. So the proceeds from Restaurant Week helps with that. The way it works is restaurants sign up to do a three-course prefixed menu. They do it in a fixed price between $20 and $120. And every time they sell that menu, they give back to Three Square $4, $5, or $6.
What are some of the restaurants that are involved this year?
There's more than 250 restaurants involved this year.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Okay, so basically all types of cuisine across the board?
All types of cuisine across the board. It's all over the valley. We have Henderson locations as well. It is probably one of the most stellar examples of community that I've ever seen.
Nice. Okay. And it's called Restaurant Week, but how long does it run?
It runs 12 days, but there is an extension week that restaurants will want to extend an extra week so they can raise even more money and have a greater impact in the community.
Okay. So when does it actually all end?
So the 12 days is the 3rd to the 14th, and the extension goes from the 15th to the 21st.
Okay. And you're expecting pretty much all of the restaurants to do the extension week as well?
No, it doesn't usually happen that way. Last year, I think we had maybe 75 out of 232. So I'm thinking probably about the same.
So how do people find out what restaurants are involved and how long they're running at that specific restaurant?
Well, they can go to restaurantweeklv.org. There is a list of all the restaurants that are participating currently and special promotions as well. I have some pro tips if you like them.
Yeah, for sure.
When you are on the website, use the filters. You can filter by cuisine. You can filter by location, by meal type and price point, and then you can filter by donation level as well. I would suggest that if you've gone on the website, when you go back to reload or refresh the page, because there could be some changes and there could be more restaurants that are joining. Sometimes they join right in the middle.
Okay. Now, Restaurant Week is kind of for the dining crowd and the people that like to go out to eat. But then you've also got an event going on, which is for the kids who are food insecure. That's called Meet Up and Eat Up. So what exactly is that program?
That is Three Square's summer food service program. It just ensures that children have access to free, nutritious meals during the summer when they're out of school, because they depend on those meals at school a lot. So it's running right now through August 9th.
Okay. And which children qualify to get the free meals?
So the meals are available for children 18 years or younger. And there are 90 locations across the valley. There are 70 traditional locations like Boys and Girls Clubs, libraries, day camps, recreation centers. And then we have 18 mobile route stops as well.
Okay. So obviously some of those, like for example, Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, the kids would have to be members at the Boys and Girls Clubs to get those meals. But if someone is listening and they know someone who's in need of getting a free meal and they are 18 or younger, where can they find those other locations that they would be eligible to visit?
They can visit the Boys and Girls Club. They can for the meal, but they can also visit any rec center in Las Vegas or Henderson. Libraries are doing it right now, so check out the libraries and several different apartment complexes as well.
Okay. And is there a list that people could access to see all the various locations that have meetup and eat up services?
Yes. It is called freesummerfood.org. Freesummerfood.org will give you a comprehensive list of all the locations.
Perfect. Okay. Now, obviously, Three Square has things going on year round. Those are a couple of things that you have going on right now. But if someone wants to get involved in helping out Three Square, either as a volunteer or maybe making a donation, where can they find out more about the organization and how to get involved?
Anyone interested in getting involved with Three Square can go to threesquare.org. And if you hit the button, give help, you can see all of the opportunities that we have for someone to give help, whether it's time or money.
Okay. And then what if someone's listening who, again, is in need of food or knows somebody who is in a food insecure family and looking for that? Where can they find out what the different locations are for adults and families to get food from Three Square?
Well, there's two ways. Go to threesquare.org and hit get help. And there's another button called Find Food, and they can click that. If they'd rather call, the Three Square Center is available 702-765-4030.
Okay, perfect. So we've got a lot of different calls to action here for you. If you want to take part in Restaurant Week, where you can go have a nice meal at one of the amazing restaurants around Las Vegas, around Southern Nevada, and order a prefixed menu and a donation will go directly to Three Square from your meal. You can find out all the restaurants that are involved and what the various different offers are at restaurantweeklv.org. That's restaurantweeklv.org. And again, Restaurant Week is running through to June 14th. And then there's the extension week for some of the restaurants. If they choose to go another week, that takes them through to June 21st. So you have a full week to take advantage of the full restaurant week, and then another week for the restaurants that are involved in the extension week. So once again, that is restaurantweeklv.org. Now, if you or a family member or a friend or neighbor is a child 18 or under in need of food, freesummerfood.org is the website for the meetup and eat up program, freesummerfood.org. And you'll see all the various locations where the kids can access those free meals, including rec centers, libraries, apartment complexes, and organizations like the Boys and Girls Clubs of Southern Nevada, freesummerfood.org. Then, if you want to find out more about Three Square and the amazing stuff that they're doing in the community, threesquare.org is the main website. If you want to get involved with donating or volunteering, you hit Give Help. And if you're interested in services, finding food, Get Help. So Give Help or Get Help at threesquare.org. And again, if you'd prefer to call 702-765-4030. 702-765-4030. And wow, so many fantastic things going on from Three Square as always. We've been speaking today with Will Edwards. He's the event marketing manager for Three Square. And Will, thank you so much for being here and letting us know all the amazing things that you're doing in the community and the different ways that people can either get involved in helping or find the food that they need. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. We appreciate it.
When students struggle because they are hungry
or fall behind because they lack school supplies,
a caring adult can make all the difference.
Especially someone from the community.
Someone who knows the students
and the obstacles they might be facing.
At Communities in Schools, our site coordinators surround students with a community of support
to ensure that they have everything they need to engage in learning.
We go all in for kids, all day, every day.
To learn more, visit communitiesinschools.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Einalim Gedahun, founder and CEO of Angels of Las Vegas. The organization's third annual Angels on the Green charity golf tournament is coming up at the end of June. Einalim, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So for those who haven't heard of the organization, what is Angels of Las Vegas?
Angels of Las Vegas was founded in 2012. We service the community as a beacon of hope and support for individuals and family going through cancer or life-threatening illnesses.
Okay. And how exactly do you help those who are suffering from cancer and other life-threatening illnesses?
Our services include financial aid, and we go into copay. We take picture of what they look like before when they lose their hair. We create human hair wig to kind of have that normal look, because sometimes when they go through chemotherapy, they lose their hair, and most of the people that can't afford the wig, we'd be able to create that wig for them. Our organization originally started by doing the wig, and from there, we start giving the nutrition care packages, which is so important when they're going through treatment. Sometimes they don't have the energy, or they don't have the appetite to eat to get the food. And we be able to give them different types of nutrition to give them like energies. And we also have educational workshop or wellness program that teach them how to do beauty, health, and wellness. We do that the first Saturday of each month for them to come in the morning from 10 o'clock in the morning until about 1 o'clock. We start by having a circle of hope, checking in with each other. From there, we do yoga meditation. And from there, we do brunch and the beauty and wellness, where we show them how to put a wig, how to take care of the wig, which is kind of being there to support, to listen to. And sometimes some of the people that are going through the treatment that might not have any family, or just to have somebody else beside the immediate family and a place for them to come in and just be a part of the community.
Nice. Okay. How does Angels of Las Vegas differ from other nonprofits in the Valley that also focus on helping people with serious illnesses?
Our organization is a little bit different because no matter what type of cancer they have, we focus in a wellness and educational workshop, and we can be a support for the individuals and families. Like, for example, it's been about 2.5 and 3 years. We are so grateful for Albertson and Vons and Sam's Club. Sometimes those families, they don't have the energy to go out and do a grocery shopping, or might not even have the financial to be able to buy groceries. So we was able to open up a food pantry where they can come every Tuesday and be able to get a food box for them to have week worth of groceries, and be able to have one-stop shop for them to come in for support, for food, for any type of social need. So that's what really makes us a little bit unique from other organizations. We all, there's so many amazing organizations. We all, our purpose is the same, helping the community. But we started this where it can be a support system, whether it's a food, whether it's a support group or art therapy for the children. So we partner with Seminole Hospital. One day out of the week, we go to the facility, the hospital, to do art therapy. And from there on, also, we have our new location that we moved in last November. We have a location where we'd be able to bring in the children to be able to have, once they are out of the hospital, we are be able to have a place for them to come in and express, you know, the art and the music therapy as well.
Wow, that's great. And in what ways do you collaborate with other nonprofits in the Valley?
The kids that we help for the social needs, they go for treatment with Cure for the Kids. That's one of the main organizations we partner up with. Seminole Hospital, St. Rose Hospital. Also, we partner some other organization that if they giving other services, and we be able to go in into their programs. And if there's something that they don't do and we do, we kind of help each other out where, for example, we partner with Three Square, we partner with Salvation Army. There's some other cancer patients that might not have the place to stay. We call Shed Tree. We do call around the community where other places have a shelter to be able to house them and things like that too.
Wow, that's fantastic. So what prompted you to found the organization back in 2012?
I'm originally from Africa, Ethiopia. After I got here, one of my, like a sister to me, one of a really good friend of mine, we grew up together. Once she joined me to come to America, once she had her green card and everything was, you know, really well and working, and she find out she got diagnosed with cancer at the time, we was in shock. It was, you know, we have so many questions. As you know, when you go to the doctor's office, they very busy. Like, we have so many questions as new diagnosed. And when she started going through it, in the beginning, she was like, I might have cancer, but cancer doesn't have me. She was very, very strong. We was trying to find a lot of support group, a lot of places where we can learn more about what she can do and what kind of food she can eat. And you have a lot of questions once you hear that news that you have cancer. You can only imagine, like, it's like your world is upside down. As a caregiver also, it's a very, very difficult because you wanted to be there for your family member, your friends, and your loved ones. But during that time, I remember my girlfriend, she was very strong and it's okay, I'm going to get through this. But as soon as she got the treatment, it didn't even take like a couple months. And as soon as she started losing her hair, that's when everything changed. She did not want to leave the house. So it was just really devastating to see her going through it. And we would go through a beauty supply store and it was really difficult because they didn't have a private wig room for her to try on. And once you lose all the hair, you know, you want it different. So wig fits different on each other's face and it's like clothes, but we were only allowed to try on one or two of them. And plus you had to try it in front of people. So she didn't want to take a scarf in front of people. During her remission, that's when, you know, her cancer was good and she had treatment. That's when I was determined to open up a beauty supply store. It was in 2008 and I have a private wig room for cancer patients. My dear friend, she was in a remission. Everything was really good. 8 months later, her cancer came back and she gained her wing. She's an angel now. She passed away. And that's when I was kind of, you know, wanted to just do more. It was a very difficult time for myself and, you know, for my friends and for all of us. And that's when I said, you know what, I wanted to do some more. And we started out by giving wig for cancer patients and they have family. We were doing toy drive. We were doing all different type of things. It's just the story that we hear and some of the stuff that they were telling us. We don't have, you know, the funds to be able to pay our copay or we don't have the money to pay our rent or things like that. Like you hear so many things that like keep adding on, like, okay, we have no energy. Let's add this program from that wig service. And from there, that we added a care packages. We partner with a company that's a fruit and vegetable and capsule. We be able to give them. They tell us, oh my God, my energy has come back and I'm feeling so much better. And from there on, just we keep adding on more and more program where we feel that needed for the patients. And it's just been with the support of the community, our sponsors, just like Albertson, Vons, Ken Ashworth, and just all the community, so many sponsors that was able to be our backbone to support us, each and everyone, our board members, our volunteers, just pouring in their hearts over 12 years now. And our organization is growing and be able to be here to hear the services in some of our cancer patients, just the way they explaining the support that we give, it just warm our hearts to be able to be there for the family.
Yeah, that's great that you were able to take tragedy and turn it into something that helps so many people.
Thank you. Thank you. If it wasn't for the community, we wouldn't be what we were doing right now. And we're just so grateful. Las Vegas is just a wonderful city and everybody just so wanted to give either the time or donations or anything that they'd be able to do. So it's just a challenge doing nonprofit, but at the same time, it just keeps you going because this is our feelings and it's been amazing for us to be able to do what we do for each and everyone that we serve here in the greater city of Las Vegas.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of support from the community, tell us about your upcoming Angels on the Green charity golf tournament.
You know, we're really excited about our Angels on the Green charity golf tournament. It's going to be in June 28th. We're looking for golf players. We're looking for sponsors, partners, and it's going to be at Angel Park Golf Course. And we want everyone just to go into our website. Our registration link is in our website. So we're very excited about our third annual Angels on the Green charity golf tournament, which is Friday, June 28th.
So the organization's called Angels of Las Vegas, the tournament's called Angels on the Green, and you were able to have it take place at Angel Park Golf Club. That's like,
yeah.
That's perfect. I mean, you couldn't have asked for it.
I know. We were like, you know, we were doing the golf tournament. This is our third annual. The first year, we're like, you know what? It's like, we need all the Angels on the Green. So we're kind of all, as a team, with our board members, with our volunteers, the committee members, like, why don't we just go ahead and call the Angels on the Green so everybody loves the name? And, you know, the first two we did in a different place. And then we finally, you know, it was just an amazing team there at Angels Park, too. They're working with us really great. So we were just really excited to do it there. And I know the whole thing, the name of the event, and the golf course's name is Angels. So it's just like this meant to be. So we just want to make it the biggest and wonderful event. And we want everyone to come out and join us and every golf lovers to come out to join us.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. So you said Friday, June 28th, and what time does it start?
It starts at 7:15 a.m. and the tournament goes in, we're going to have a lot of great prizes, and we have some exciting stuff in the hole too. Like, you know how it is, golf tournaments always really fun and amazing. So we're really excited about that. So it'll probably go on until about 3:30, and it's going to be included food, and it's going to be a really great day.
Nice. Okay. And what types of growth do you have planned for the future?
A lot of people calling us the past almost 7 years now. People be calling us from Arizona, from, you know, California. They do be getting a lot of calls and everything. And, you know, for myself, and I'm from different country, like I told you, from Africa. You know, I lost my mother 3 years ago from cancer. Other family members throughout the years. I mean, each of us has been touched by, you know, life-threatening illness, by losing your family members. So we get a lot of calls, and everybody's like, are you guys, you know, we're in such and such city that we thought about it. We're like, you know what? If, you know, with God's help, with the committee's help, we want to take this nationally and maybe in the future internationally. So we have a goal to open in Arizona. We have a goal to open in California and North Carolina and Washington, D.C., Oregon. And just we meet so many amazing people going through networking and just never know where you meet people. So when they hear about what we do, they're like, oh, my God, there's nothing. All kinds of survivors as well. They're like, when I was going through it, we didn't have a service like this. So our long-term goal is to be able to open nationally and in the future internationally. So that's kind of what we're working toward.
Perfect. Okay. So where can people go if they want to get more information about Angels of Las Vegas? Maybe if they want to support the organization by donating, volunteering, that kind of thing, or sign up to take part in the Angels on the Green Golf Tournament?
Yes, our website is angelsoflv.org, angelsoflv.org. They can go to our website and be able to get all that information. They can fill out a form for volunteers. And now first page also, there's a form for anyone would like to either donation or like to play golf. They can register for the golf and they would like to sponsor. All our sponsorship or registration is also on our first page. Anyone would like to volunteer, there's also a volunteer form. And anyone is in need of our support also, there is intake form in our website that they can be able to complete, and we'll be able to reach out to them and let them know what program that we have.
Okay, fantastic. So once again, angelsoflv.org is the website to go to, angelsoflv.org. You can find out more about Angels of Las Vegas. If you want to support the organization by making a donation, volunteering, you can do that there. If you're in need of services, you can also submit an application there. And if you want to take part in the third annual Angels on the Green Charity Golf Tournament, that's happening on Friday, June 28th, starts at 7:15 with an 8 a.m. shotgun start. And that's happening at Angel Park Golf Club, 100 South Rampart. And looks like a fun day. There's food, raffle prizes, award ceremony, live music, all kinds of stuff. And again, you can sign up or find out more at angelsoflv.org. And we've been speaking with Einalem Gadahun. She's the founder and CEO of Angels of Las Vegas. And Einalem, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about the organization and the amazing stuff you're doing for the community, and also about your upcoming Angels on the Green golf tournament. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Heather, for having me. I really, really appreciate the support.
Hey, life doesn't stop when cancer starts. After diagnosis, treatment is vital. But for some, just getting there to appointments, chemo, or radiation is a major challenge. You can change that. Volunteer to give rides with the American Cancer Society Road to Recovery Program. Driving for a few hours of your day can make a life-saving difference for someone with cancer. Visit cancer.org/drive to learn more.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm speaking with Dr. Julie Schwartzbard, a leading neurologist who specializes in Alzheimer's disease research and treatment. June is Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month, and medical advances are bringing new hope to patients and families living with Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Schwartzbard, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So how common is Alzheimer's in the U.S.?
So early Alzheimer's disease in the U.S. is about 4.5 million people. And it's interesting to know that only half of them have been diagnosed. There's a real disconnect between the patients who have early disease and those who come to diagnosis. And part of that is because it can be tricky to make the diagnosis, right? How do we distinguish between benign aging, having senior moment, versus early Alzheimer's disease? There are some clues. Patients who consistently repeat themselves, or they're consistently forgetting conversations, they're regularly misplacing personal items or getting lost behind the wheel, those are all red flags and reasons why they should undergo an evaluation. You know, Alzheimer's disease begins early on with the accumulation of abnormal proteins in the brain. The earliest protein is called beta amyloid. And as it deposits in the brain, it can cause like these clumpy plaques. And it's the presence of these clumpy plaques that is thought to cause the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease.
Huh. Okay. So what is the process of getting an actual diagnosis when those types of symptoms are appearing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, first, you got to get the patient to the doctor, right? And that's not always easy, because patients with early Alzheimer's often lose insight. They lose their ability to recognize that they're losing their memory. And so it can be tricky getting them in to see the doctor. That's why it's so important for family and friends, when they see these problems in someone, to make sure they go ahead and see a doctor. Once you go for an evaluation, there's testing that can be done now. There's confirmatory testing that can be done either via a PET scan, an amyloid PET scan. So that abnormal amyloid that I was talking about, that lights up on a PET scan if it presents. Also, an alternative way to undergo diagnosis is with CSF, cerebrospinal fluid analysis. That's like a lumbar puncture, what we used to call a spinal tap. That also can show the presence of amyloid and other abnormal proteins. There's also now a blood test. The blood test is not confirmatory. It's more of a screening test. But patients can now undergo a blood test. And if it's positive, would suggest that they need to move forward with more diagnostic testing.
Okay, so that testing should be done as soon as possible after we realize that in ourselves or a loved one, it's a pattern and not just random senior moments.
That's exactly right. And the earlier, the better, for lots of reasons. First of all, we want to plan, right? These are our family members. These are our loved ones. And so we want to make sure they're safe. So once a patient has a diagnosis, we know that they need to be monitored. We know we can manage expectations, help with financial planning. And also, you know, this is a really exciting time in the Alzheimer's research world, because there are new treatments coming about. Many of these treatments actually are anti-amyloid. So they bring that amyloid out of the brain. These medications, though, really work best early on. So the earlier a patient is offered this medication, if it's appropriate, then the better. All treatment options come with potential side effects, though, and it's important to keep in mind that these new treatments do come with potential side effects that need to be considered in any individual person.
Okay. Now, when we say early Alzheimer's disease, it refers to early in the disease's lifetime. But is there an age for people that we should specifically start taking a closer look and considering those symptoms to be more serious?
Sure, that's a really good question. Certainly over the age of 65, under the age of 65 would be considered early onset Alzheimer's disease. Another interesting thing to keep in mind is that this abnormal accumulation of amyloid can occur sometimes 10 to 20 years before the onset of symptoms, we call preclinical. So now the diagnosis can actually be made before patients even have symptoms. And that helps us understand that once someone does eventually present with symptoms, they already have this abnormal deposition in their brain. And that's another reason why early treatment is so important.
Interesting. Okay. And again, what are some of the new treatments that are available today that might not have been available 10 to 20 years ago?
So this idea of anti-amyloid, a medication that can bring amyloid out of the brain, is what's being investigated. There are some new medications coming to market that are anti-amyloid drugs. Like I said, they can have potential side effects. One important one is called ARIA, A-R-I-A, amyloid-related imaging abnormality. This is generally a radiographic phenomenon, something that's seen on an MRI. But it can be symptomatic and it can be quite serious. And that's why if someone does have the diagnosis of early Alzheimer's and they are offered this medication, it's always important to weigh the risk-benefit ratio.
Okay. And if the medication is right for a patient, what kind of life does the patient then have?
Well, these medications are showing that in many cases, they can slow down the course of the disease. And that's exciting. It's exciting to us because we haven't had any medication that could slow down the course of the disease before now. So, you know, we're hoping for a cure in the future, but at least now patients will hopefully have the opportunity to consider a medication that can slow things down.
Okay. So where can listeners go if they want to find out more about early Alzheimer's disease, about the signs and symptoms, the diagnostic, the treatments that are available specifically for Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month, but obviously anytime?
Sure. There are so many resources online. I happen to really like the Alzheimer's Association website. It's ALZ.org, ALZ.org, and they have many, many resources on that website.
Okay, nice. So ALZ.org is the website for the Alzheimer's Association. It's a nonprofit. There's plenty of information there about Alzheimer's disease and new processes, treatments, diagnostics. So ALZ.org. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Julie Schwartzbard. She's a leading neurologist who specializes in Alzheimer's disease. And Dr. Schwartzbard, I want to thank you so much for bringing this to our attention, the new advancements that many people probably aren't aware of. So I really appreciate you being here today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mom's early Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard to take.
And when I left the oven on, we decided together that it was time to see a doctor and make a plan.
Early detection gave us more time to seek out information and support as a family.
If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together. For more information, visit alz.org/timetotalk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Scott Montgomery, author of the new book, How Did You Get Here? Lessons of Unconventional Success. Scott, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what inspired you to write this book? How did you get here? Lessons of Unconventional Success.
You know, I feel that grief and loss pushed me into reviewing my life, my relationships, and what I valued about the work I do. You know, I wanted to put my energy into moving the story of my successes forward for the readers so that they can parallel their own experiences. You know, I think this book is more of a life and leadership memoir for me. And I wrote it at a time where, you know, my brother had recently passed and we were going right into COVID. So I think it was a collection of reflections that inspired the book.
Okay. And what is your philosophy on success?
So I think for me, what I captured in the book are the lessons of unconventional success that I have found over the years. And, you know, I think leadership comes with compassion. And I also believe that the things that I talk about in the book, partnerships, relationships, goals, habits, and communicating, they're all part of the components of good and solid leadership. And so I thought it was a good way to map my experiences to those lessons for my readers.
Okay. And what's unconventional about the way you approach those things?
So I think I call it unconventional because I didn't really excel as a student in my early years, and I didn't find conventional classroom learning to be tantalizing. I didn't think that that's where I wanted to be, and I thought as a result I wouldn't be successful. And I have found over the years applying the things that I talk about in the book, goals, habits, relationships, partnerships, and so on, that those things are really what helped lift me and traject my career into the successes that far exceeded that of a failing student in college. So I call it unconventional for those reasons.
Okay. Now, you mentioned relationships and partnerships, and we always hear that, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. So how important is it to form and maintain relationships, both personal and professional?
So I think that's the cornerstone to the whole concept of my successes and the book. So I'm really glad you asked that question. It really brings to light the genesis of all of it. And for me, it's not necessarily who you know, it's what you do with who you know and how you honor those relationships and how you can formulate trust and you can build something together with someone versus expect someone to lead you along or pull you up. So for me, it's been how do we massage those relationships? How do you honor those relationships? And how do you help people advance their own careers, therefore advancing your own? And leading. I think leading teams and having that compassion and forging those relationships is going to make that a much more solid offering for whatever it is you're trying to deliver.
Okay. And how do you recommend that we do honor those relationships and tap into various people that we know and use that towards our own success without feeling like we're using our friends and using the people we know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I would never promote using our friends. As a matter of fact, a lot of the folks that I've worked with over the years are actually now working at my firm as a serendipitous sort of ceremonial capstone to our careers. Some of the folks that hired me and brought me into the world earlier are now working at my firm as they move into retirement. And I think for me, the key component is networking and not being afraid to put yourself out there. And the more important aspect of that is how are you being received is something you should be paying attention to. It's not about the get, it's about the give, you know, and it's about how you can map those two things together for mutual benefit. And I think I have really found success in that. And that's why I call it a guide to lessons of unconventional success. It becomes very serendipitous for everyone. And networking, honoring friendships and relationships, and authenticity.
Okay. And what kind of mindset is required to achieve success?
So, you know, I think another component is I've learned a lot about mindset, and there are a lot of books and a lot of experts out there. For me, you know, I like to create a vision. I work on my habits. I accept feedback. I'm willing and focused and engaged to create results is all part of a mindset of can do, you know, and I think it's a collection of those kind of things. I'm not an expert in, you know, Carol Dweck has a really good concept of growth mindset. And I make reference to that because I'm really into that model, but I'm not an expert in that area. But if you can open yourself up, and you can be willing and accept feedback, and you can work towards a common goal, I think that's exactly how you apply a positive mindset to your growth.
Nice. Okay. Now, you mentioned your firm. What does your firm do?
So WorldGate was founded in early 2002, and we are a systems integrator, ironically enough, for school districts. So we work typically on the business side of IT in school districts, and we support many of the large school districts on the East Coast. And we've been doing that for about 20 years, and we have about 100 employees.
Nice. Okay. So if people want to kind of follow in your footsteps or learn some of the lessons that you've learned without having to necessarily go through them the hard way, where can they go for more information or even to get your book, How Did You Get Here? Lessons of Unconventional Success?
I love that question, and thank you for asking it. You know, while the book is primarily my stories, at the end of each chapter, I make a point to ask 5 very specific questions to reflect, for the reader to reflect how they could apply that story to their experience. Secondly, I'm putting together a companion guide that should be available to your listeners. And lastly, you can go to howdidyougethere.com, where you can find links to buy the book on Amazon. You can buy the companion guide, and we have some PDFs that people can download that will help them start to formulate how to structure setting up their goals and their habits.
Wow, that's awesome. I love when a book comes with, you know, study materials and action tools that let people actually get results from the book.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, that website, howdidyougethere.com, howdidyougethere.com. The book is called How Did You Get Here? Lessons of Unconventional Success. So at the website, you can find links to get the book. You can find it on Amazon. You can also get the companion study pieces that Scott mentioned at, again, the website, howdidyougethere.com. And we've been speaking today with Scott Montgomery, who is the author of that book, How Did You Get Here? Lessons of Unconventional Success. And Scott, I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing some of your lessons of unconventional success with us and how people can also achieve their own success. So thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Only 1 in 5 people with autism are employed, despite many having the skill set and desire to work.
Maybe it's because employers don't know what kind of jobs they can do. Like, what about a programmer?
That's a job for someone with autism.
How about a healthcare worker?
Yep, that is too. People with autism can do a lot of different jobs, but often get overlooked due to outdated stigmas. Introducing WIN by Autism Speaks. We help businesses lead the way in inclusive hiring.
What about a ranch hand?
To learn more, go to autismspeaks.org/win.
From Odyssey, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, this is I'm Listening, Talk Away the Dark, a limited series.
Today, Corey Crockett hosts an intimate conversation on mental health and suicide prevention in the LGBTQIA+ community. Corey is joined by the Chief Medical Officer for the Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Dr. Christine U. Moutier, and Bradley Belandis, longtime American Foundation for Suicide Prevention volunteer. Now, here's Corey Crockett.
And welcome in to this episode of I'm Listening, Talk Away the Dark. This month's discussion is focused on mental health and suicide prevention in the LGBTQ+ community. Hi, my name is Corey, and we're joined today by Dr. Christine U. Moutier. She's the Chief Medical Officer at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, who is our partner with this podcast, and Bradley Belandis, who is an advocate and a longtime volunteer at AFSP. Welcome to the both of you.
Thanks, Corey, and great to be here with you, Bradley, as well.
Thank you so much for having us.
So it's Pride Month, and I was thinking about how to begin this conversation. And for the past several months, we've been producing this show as a way to encourage people to talk about the dark parts of mental health and suicide and validating feelings and fears. And so I feel like the best way to encapsulate why we're here today and why this focus for the LGBTQ+ community and its allies is so important is this headline. And it's jarring, but it comes from a survey from the Trevor Project, discovering that 39% of LGBTQ+ youth between the ages of 13 and 24 have said they have seriously considered suicide in the past year. And among those people surveyed, 12% said that they had attempted suicide in the past year. That's a lot to think about. But Bradley, as a member of the community and a longtime mental health advocate, what is your reaction to a statistic like that?
I think it's extremely concerning, but I'll also say not surprising. I have been a queer young person, and so I know firsthand what it feels like to be marginalized and to not have the support that you need when it comes to mental health.
And what about you, Dr. Moutier?
These are really troubling statistics, and yet we know that people in the human species, all of us, have mental health and will face challenges and suffer at times. For LGBTQ people, and especially youth, as they're coming into their own understanding of their own identity, but living in a world, in a community, or even family environment that is less than affirming, where the messages are not always aligned with what we want our children and youth, you know, in any community and any family to be hearing, which is that you are loved unconditionally, you're amazing, you're growing, and it's okay to make mistakes. You know, we all have mental health, we'll all suffer, and there's help and support available. You know, I think it is definitely a call to action, and I feel like it's incumbent upon all of us, no matter who you are, where you live, what, you know, who's in your family or your own identity, but it's on all of us to create an environment that is accepting, loving, and affirming to all people, including queer people.
And we'll get into some of the data around what it's like when queer youth are surrounded by support in the home. But I think you bring up a good point about identity and discovery and things that queer youth are going through. Not just, first of all, being a teenager, as tumultuous as it is. And then being a queer teenager is adding another element to self-discovery. You know, Bradley, I feel like you had mentioned when we were talking, planning for this podcast, that it was in joining AFSP that you were able to look back at some of those moments in your childhood. Is that correct?
You're right. Volunteering through AFSP really allowed me to confront my past, so to speak, as a young queer person. I had an extremely rough time coming out. I grew up in a small town on the Erie Canal, and that small town did not react well when I came out at 15. I got kicked off my soccer team. Classmates drove to my house and they vandalized it and they ripped out a tree in my yard. And I had to explain to my dad what that meant and why it was happening. And I even had times where I had to defend myself in physical altercations. And there was a day that I was really in a dark place. And my teacher turned to me and she said, "First, you're an amazing person and I support you. And the second thing is I want you to tell me if you ever have feelings of hurting yourself." And to be perfectly honest, I had been thinking about hurting myself. And in that moment, being able to have a real conversation, I felt for the first time seen and safe and like I had permission to talk about my mental health. And my teacher, shout out to Mrs. Horgan, my health teacher, was able to direct me to resources, a guidance counselor. We called it our GSA, Gay Straight Alliance, which helped me immensely.
Dr. Moutier, you know, Bradley talks about having someone in his life who was able to not just give him acceptance, but also help him talk away the dark, as it were. How important is that for people in positions to be supportive to queer teens to give that support?
It can be a game changer. And, you know, it's a role that's kind of what I'm alluding to. Like, any of us can play that role, whether you're a teacher, a coach, a youth pastor, a parent, or a peer. And, you know, so really it's just about being attuned to the fact that people do struggle. And that's in a way, it's normal to struggle. And once you learn that we don't have to have, you know, a worry about approaching a peer or a student, a loved one who might be suffering. And you can pick up on those cues through, you know, behavior changes and withdrawing. Their tone of voice might change. They might be losing their temper more or drinking or using substances more. There are lots of different kinds of tip-offs, and they can be really subtle sometimes. But asking and showing curiosity and caring, I think, is the combination that I think about. And when I open up the caring conversation, I always start with, I'm not here to judge you. I'm really interested to know how you're doing because I want to know how to care about you more, how to support you better as a, whatever it is, friend, teacher, counselor. And really just open up that safe space that you make it clear there's no judgment so they can just start sharing their story. And then asking if they're having thoughts of suicide, if it seems like there is a tone of hopelessness or feeling trapped or overwhelmed or like they might feel like a burden to others, those are all sure signs that the person is there's a pretty decent chance that they've been thinking about ending their life, not because people are obsessed with death or dying, but because they're thinking of how to cope with the pain and the circumstance that they're in. And allowing them to share that can sometimes just take the power out of it and allow them to then open up, speak more freely and authentically. And many times it's the first step of them getting the help that they need, you know, in a more ongoing way.
And you talk about caring. I think, you know, for this group in particular, the LGBTQ plus community right now, there feels to be an intense lack of empathy in some parts of the country and certainly a part of a national discourse that I think can weigh on queer people. And as we're talking about queer youth in particular, to feel like the world is against me or how do I face these struggles that are happening outside of my control? And they feel like they're weighing on me. Do you have any advice or thoughts, even separating this from politics? I think it's objectively a difficult time to work through finding your own identity for some people and then living authentically.
As you said, it is a scary time to be a queer person. I lived in Texas for 10 years. I just moved. I've said this. I was very lucky to live in Texas. I loved being there. But also, state-level policy does influence culture and attitudes towards different communities. And bringing it back to mental health, it affected me for sure. But I can only imagine if you were a 14-year-old trans kid, how would you feel? How would that affect your mental health? And so I always say, I don't think that suicide is a partisan issue, right? I think that kindness and respect should not be political, full stop.
And Dr. Moutier, AFSP has come out against many of these bills as well from a medical standpoint.
Yes, we did. And we've done that because there's research that shows that having full access to mental health care and medical care is essential for protecting the mental health of all people. And because some of this legislation really significantly looks to restrict access to care for trans kids, for LGBTQ populations, that it works against preventing suicide. And so we're very selective in our policy work about where we take a stand. And that was a very clear line in the sand for us.
And so let's talk about available resources and not just, you know, focusing on maybe the dearth of resources in some places. You know, mental health access for the LGBTQ plus community and young adults too is really important. And it looks different depending on where you go around the country, you know, what kind of resources are available, I would say, first for someone who is thinking of harming themselves or someone else?
Well, there's certainly 988 as our main national suicide and crisis lifeline that does have a press 3 option for LGBTQ people. And you'll be connected with a trained counselor no matter where you are in the United States 24/7. So we do absolutely recommend 988, and you don't have to be suicidal to call that number. I highly recommend the Trevor Project, Trevor Space, as a safe space for queer youth or questioning youth to really, you know, have community and in a way that doesn't necessarily rely on who is in your physical neighborhood or school, but a way to connect with safe folks online.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I will plug AFSP that if you go to afsp.org, there is a full central place to find resources specifically for queer people. And I know that there are lots of concerns right now for our community, but at the same time, we have never had greater access to tools and technology, right? We live in the age of the internet. And when I came out nearly 20 years ago, I didn't have a text line that I could text. I did not even have internet. So I do want to make sure that communities know that there are technologies and tools that you can leverage. For instance, a text line or an instant message line that even if you don't have the ability to speak on the phone, you can go to a safe space and access a text and chat service.
And in particular, you know, we talk about the LGBTQ plus community as a community for a reason, right? And I think we've learned that having a strong community, a strong network is also supportive for all types of people that are going through mental health distress. Is that the case?
Yeah, research shows that for all people, a sense of connection and a sense of being supported, heard, and understood is a protective experience. And so when you think about anyone who may be suffering and becoming at risk for suicide, and certainly for queer people, that sense of community and connection is essential. And again, I'll just mention that as a parent of a young adult who is trans and having just walked through a 3-year journey as a family, experiencing our child's transition and all of the stages of that, learning so much, even though we've been advocates for a long time, that lived experience of the risk that it takes for a young person to do that, even within a sort of safe, supportive family, there's still a lot of fear. That experience is so important to understand. And the difference that we as a family, but certainly others in the community, in a friend group or in a faith community, can make to a young person, or frankly, anyone at any age, is huge.
I agree with Dr. Moutier, but I do want to emphasize the importance of people outside of the community speaking up on behalf of LGBTQIA plus young people and all people. We need allies and champions to speak up on our behalf. And arguably, those people can be even more influential because they can break through to communities and ideologies that otherwise wouldn't support our community.
Bradley Belandis and Dr. Christine Yu-Moutier, I can't thank you enough for spending this time and having this conversation. You know, I think sometimes it's hard for people to talk about it and it's hard to devote a lot of time to talk about it. And I'm glad we took the time to do so. And I think that's the spirit of the campaign Talk Away the Dark that AFSP has put so much work behind. So I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Dr. Moutier.
To find out more about Talk Away the Dark, please visit afsp.org. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988. For the full show and more stories like this one, download the I'm Listening podcast on the Odyssey app or visit imlistening.org.
Did you know that those with mental health challenges can be right in front of our eyes but still go unseen? Behind some smiles, there's hidden pain because our struggles aren't always on the surface. And they can affect anyone, anywhere, at any time. It's okay not to feel okay. There's strength in connecting and seeking help. Share, connect, get informed. Your mental health is in your hands. Visit melaninthriving.com/mental health in your hands.
This message brought to you by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Las Vegas Restaurant Week to support Three Square takes place through Friday, June 14th, with over 250 participating restaurants. Find out all the details at restaurantweeklv.org. Also, the organization's Meet Up and Eat Up program to provide free meals for food insecure kids runs through Friday, August 9th. Find out more at freesummerfood.org. That's freesummerfood.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, June 17th at 8 p.m. benefiting Youth Leadership Authority, and Monday, July 1st at 8 p.m. benefiting the Love Yourself Foundation. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Golden Ticket Raffle to benefit Junior Achievement of Southern Nevada is back with an updated prize structure, including weekly drawings and a choice of three prize buckets. Tickets are on sale through midnight on June 24th, and the drawing happens at a cocktail reception on June 27th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Virgin Hotel's Manor Room. Check out the prizes, buy raffle tickets, or RSVP for the drawing event at thegoldenticket.org. That's thegoldenticket.org. Angels of Las Vegas is holding their third annual Angels on the Green charity golf tournament honoring National Men's Health Month on Friday, June 28th with an 8 a.m. shotgun start at Angel Park Golf Club, 100 South Rampart. Find out more or sign up to play at angelsoflv.org. That's angelsoflv.org. And the Las Vegas Clark County Library District is holding their annual Free Summer Challenge Reading and Activities Program through July 31st. Find out more or get started at thelibrarydistrict.org/summerchallenge. That's thelibrarydistrict.org/summerchallenge.